I plan to go to law school after I graduated, but, looks like my folks won't have enough money to put me through college.
Well, the world needs ditch diggers, too.
Entrepreneurship, scaling business plans. Then I became the CEO man. Are you ready to be mentored by some of the best minds in entrepreneurship in the world? Then you're listening to the right podcast, Ditch Digger CEO. We're going to be interviewing CEOs and founders who will be telling their amazing rags to riches stories. These entrepreneurs who dominate the industries they serve will be sharing the secrets to their success. We'll be talking to millionaires and billionaires. Many who started with nothing. You're going to be mentored with golden nuggets of shared experiences from my guest, whose time is worth thousands and even tens of thousands of dollars per hour. I started in the paving business right out of high school, and with no college education, mentorship has been my education of choice. I started over 25 companies in the last 20 years, have generated over $1.5 billion in revenues. My guarantee is this. If you listen to Ditch Digger CEO and you want to be more successful, you will become more successful. The secrets of my success and for many of the world's greatest business leaders will be revealed. Let Ditch Digger CEO mentor you.
All right, here we are today at Ditch Digger CEO. We're interviewing, this is number four, I think, right? So this is number four. And our goal here is to interview some of the best minds in entrepreneurship and startups and business leadership in the world. And I'll tell you what, we got somebody here today I consider one of the top minds in the world when it comes to startups, when it comes to venture capital, when it comes to amazing entrepreneurial ideas. This friend of mine, I am so blessed to have this guy as my buddy. Every time I talk to him, I'm energized, and you're going to get energized by listening to the way this guy's mind thinks. So, Bijou, welcome, my buddy Bijou, to today's podcast. Done a lot of amazing things, and introduce yourself there, partner.
Thanks so much, Gary. Great to be here. It's an honor. So, Bijou Kulatharkal, I'm the CEO of Halo Investing, and we're a financial technology company. We make safer investments for retail investors around the world. I've done a couple of different startups before this, most notably as one of the early co-founders of a company called Redbox, which a lot of few people have heard of. And then outside of that, I just really like tech startups in general, and I like doing things that are positive sum, net positive sum for the world. Those are the things that really motivate me.
Absolutely. And again, when you think about the difference that Redbox made in an industry, it's awesome to think about what happened there, and heck, it's doing it, even today. It's doing well. It's not the fit everywhere, I guess, right? From what I'm hearing, but it's still a strong company. Can you tell us a little bit about that? The startup of that, how that happened, where you were at in your life at that point? You know, what made you think about this this box that spit out DVDs?
It was a very long time ago, and you know, my interest was not so much in movies or in movie rental for that matter, but it was really around automation. So, you know, things that make life more efficient for us and easier for us are always interesting to me. So I you know, that's sort of how I came around to the idea. I had two other friends who had, you know, had come up with sort of that concept too. And, you know, I worked, they came up with one part of the idea, I came up with a different part of the idea. We started working on this as a company. It was called Get a Movie back then. And just like all other ideas, it started out as something different and went through a few different iterations to get mm-hmm. here. And, you know, we never probably in our biggest dreams at that point imagine it would be what it became today. We had the company. It was very small, and we were actually we created the first few prototype machines and had rolled it out into a Jewel Osco and a few other retail locations. And along the way, McDonald's Corporation, basically, they were, this was back in the early 2000s, they were basically looking at automated retail, like what's the future of retail? What else can they do with McDonald's? And I don't know if you know this, but McDonald's is one of the largest owners of real estate in the world, of retail real estate in the world. So very specifically retail real estate. So something that's key with McDonald's is, you know, something Ray Kroc always said is, he's not in the hamburger business, he's in the real estate business.
Exactly.
And what they've done that's key with their franchise contracts is that they either own the location or directly lease the location and then, you know, have a contract with the franchisee.
Mm-hmm.
So they've done that from the very beginning, and they've been very successful with that. That's a key part of the innovation they had in their business from, you know, 60, 70 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were wondering, hey, at that point, what can they do? What's the future of retail? What can they do with all this retail real estate they have? And one of the ideas they had at that point was to put automated concepts on it. So the original Red Box was an automated, something like an automated 7-Eleven, if you can imagine that.
Sure.
It was like a large wall size kiosk, and that was put out at the first, you know, they piloted at like 10 or 15 locations, mostly on the East Coast. And that was what Redbox originally was.
How did that partnership begin? In other words, did McDonald's see you guys or your idea? Did you guys go to them? How did that come about?
So we had originally, I think, reached out to them a long time ago. And just like all partnerships, you know, the first time we kind of talked about it, it was not maybe the exact fit for them because they were still doing that automated retail, that 7-Eleven kind of concept.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but later on they noticed, okay, you know, that original concept was not working, but then they needed to do something else to make automated retail work. And then that ended up being these DVD kiosks. So their whole idea was to have the DVD kiosk then to bring customers to McDonald's. That was the whole strategic idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked
and
them.
And at this point, they knew you guys were you guys Get a Movie at this point? And
we were Get a Movie at that point. And Redbox at that point was just a project within McDonald's.
Okay.
It was not even a separate company. So it was just a project that McDonald's was running. Then as it became clearer that this DVD business was going to be the main business for retail at McDonald's, at Redbox,
mm-hmm.
And you know, they didn't have the technology. I mean, we basically have the technology to do this. So they decided to spin out Redbox as a separate company with McDonald's and the Get a Movie shareholders as founding shareholders.
Okay.
In that. So that's how that concept came about. And from then, you know, the great thing McDonald's brought to the table is they brought all this real estate, and they brought a lot of capital,
mm-hmm.
and they also brought a great team. And so that really helped us scale that business.
Can I ask you one question? Did you guys ever go to, let's say, Blockbuster with this idea or Hollywood Videos, any of those guys?
Absolutely. We went to all of them. We went to Blockbuster, Hollywood Video, and Movie Gallery.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? You know, the interesting thing I learned from that experience, and by the way, all of them, like, they all said, no, this is not going to work, okay? And they're all out of business now, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's this is something that's really interesting. You learn from any industry. It's a lesson that applies to any industry when you try to do innovation is when you approach the incumbent in an industry, someone who's already in that space,
mm-hmm.
They are more concerned about how are they going to transition their current business mm-hmm. to whatever that new business is. And that's a lot of risk for them.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's actually a hard concept for most people to get. I mean, you know, it's maybe easy to look at Blockbuster and say, hey, you know what, they should have done this or they should have done that.
Mm-hmm.
But when you really think about it, 99% of Fortune 500 companies really have the same problem.
Sure.
And it's a very human problem because you're doing something, you're waking up every morning and you're doing something that's your main business. And you know, in some ways, maybe your main business needs to change to do something different, but it's hard for a lot of people to make that transition. It's just a very hard thing to do.
The expense and the risk of change is huge, right?
Yeah, and you know, the way companies are run right now with quarterly earnings cycles, you know, a very short-term mentality, the risk reward is set up that way.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a blessing for people like me who are startup entrepreneurs, because we have the ability basically to do the innovation off a company's balance sheet in a separate, you know, in a separate vehicle. And at some point, you know, companies like mine either go public or they get acquired by a bigger company, because they see that as the only way to innovate in the future. But it's interesting you say that, because with Blockbuster and Hollywood Video and all these other players at that point, right? The incumbent saw it very difficult to take the innovative step, because that innovation affected their core business. What was interesting with McDonald's was that for them, this was just, you know, it was a side bet. It was a side bet, and it was just the worst that they could lose for the most part was really some money, which is not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. So one key lesson I learned out of that is that you know, sometimes when you try to innovate and you want to change something in a field, it's not always the best idea to go to somebody who's already completely in that field, unless that person is willing to make that leap.
Sure. So, you know, somebody like McDonald's at the time, I think weren't they into their own venture capital type of organization at the time, and they're looking for other things outside burgers and all that, right? And I think they'd acquired a few companies back then, and so they're into that. And I think that, you know, since then, I think they've moved out of that from what I've seen. You know, the Chipotles of the world, I think they've sold that, and as well as Redbox and others, right?
Yeah, they got out of all the other they got out of Redbox and all the other ventures, because because again, few companies, although they have corporate venture arms, really make the transition of managing a super innovative but different businesses in their portfolio with their existing stable cash cows.
Right.
And Chipotle is a good example. McDonald's sold that at a, you know, maybe $2 or $3 billion valuation. But it went public not long after, and the value went to us, I think, $12 or $15 billion. So you
still
know,
growing, and they're still the highest they've ever been, I think, recently.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what are your biggest lessons in that whole? And you mentioned one or two there. What think about your biggest lessons in that whole experience? You know, joining partners with a behemoth of McDonald's. And anything you would have done differently? Do you feel like you guys did all the right stuff looking back?
So, I mean, you know, as a startup, you're always making mistakes, right? The thing is not about what you do right or about getting everything right, but it's really about, hey, just surviving through all your mistakes, but doing better, improving from all your mistakes. That's really all it is. When I look at people who've succeeded and who failed, the only people who succeed, in my experience, the people around me, the people who've succeeded are the people who've just like gone past and done better after making mistakes. The people who don't make mistakes are the people who haven't tried.
Yeah.
Right? That's totally the
part of the process of strong growth in entrepreneurship, right, is failing fast, understanding, you know, what caused the failure. How do you learn from it? How can you be better for it, right? And that's our opinion here.
Absolutely. So I think in terms of the lessons, you know, key lessons that I learned, I guess, from the Redbox experience was that, A, when it comes to innovation, you know, who you think as the most intuitive or natural partners for you originally are not the best partners for you to really change the industry, because the future of any industry is not just an extrapolation of the present, but it's something which is very disruptive. And it applies to all businesses. If you look at the Fortune 500 or even the top 50 companies in the U.S. today, it's radically different than the top 50 companies in the U.S. 40 years ago.
Absolutely.
So you'll see that on a constant level across the board. The other thing I learned about business from that experience too is that, you know, the biggest reward you're always going to have is impact. So I think even with Redbox, the biggest reward from Redbox that I saw was basically seeing a business, a technology that a lot of America, I would say 60-70% of America have used at some point. And they're happy with, you know, and that's going to be the best thing that you're ever going to get out of a business.
Sure.
So after that business, I really focused on focusing on impact. You know, impact is the most important reward from a business, and that's the same in my current business too. If you, I can talk to you later about like the values that are important to us in our current business, but the number one value, and we say this every day at our company today, is impact. And we actually have a phrase in our office. It says impact before profits, because that's important to us.
Yeah, and profits will come if you impact an industry as you guys have in your past life and I know what you're doing today. You're gonna impact lives in your industry like maybe never before. Your profits will come and they'll be there.
Absolutely, and the other thing is when in the dashboard of life. Right. When you look at the dashboard of life, if the speedometer or the dials, the things you're looking at, have to do only with dollars, you're going to make the wrong decisions.
Absolutely.
So you're going to make the wrong decisions long term because you have to really think long term. You want to think of a business it's not a business for the next quarter or the next, you know, year, but for the next 50 or 100 years. And the best way to think for the next 50 or 100 years is to look at impact and not dollars. And the cool thing, the great thing about life, though, the great thing about life in general is that when you focus on that impact, the profits sort of take care of itself.
Exactly.
And that's really the truth.
So we're, you know, I've known you for, gosh, maybe 10 years, 12 years we've been buddies.
Yeah.
And didn't take long for us to be buddies either. I mean, I feed off your energy and it's been a lot of fun.
And that's mutual.
So when I think about you know, you've been a wise son of a gun for you're a young guy still. In your early 30s when I first met you, you're almost as wise as you are today. You've gained some for sure, right? But you know, who was your mentors that created the awareness that you gained about business, about impact, and about life in general?
I think the most important mentors in my life by far have been my parents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've been the by far the most important mentors in my life, and that's from a very early age. You know, my dad was an entrepreneur. I mean, he was a journalist and entrepreneur in his own way, and he really taught me like the importance of networking, of getting to know people. That being successful is not just about knowing things, but about knowing people. Mm. And working with people, because it's not just about how good you are, but about the people you convince, you can share your vision and ideas with.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught me that early on. And the great thing about having parents as mentors is that you learn some of these things. You learn some of these lessons even subconsciously. Without thinking that they're lessons.
You don't even know you're learning, right?
That's exactly right. You don't even know you're learning. Those are like the best mentors.
Yeah.
You know, where Absolutely. It's not a lesson, where it's just part of the part of something you learn because of it's an example.
Sure.
And my dad being an entrepreneur, and that he taught me the value of networking, knowing people, and thinking that everything is possible. He always taught me at a very young age that everything's possible, that I could do it, you know. My mom, in a different way, she's also an entrepreneur. She really taught me more about like managing risk and analyzing things and looking at like making sure I manage the downside in situations too.
Mm-hmm.
So I think both those different views brought like a good balance to me.
Absolutely.
And along the way, in you know, different businesses, I've always been lucky. I've had different people I worked with, people I worked for, you know, who've mentored me in different ways. But I would say the most important mentors in my life would be my parents.
Awesome.
Hey, so I wanted to actually ask you, because I'm looking up Forbes right now, right? One of the things that they talk about when it comes to networking, if you can expound on it, Gary, and a lot of people want to know, because everyone says you have to network in order to become successful. But a lot of the things that they're saying that holds people back is their mindset. They limit their network, they aren't strategic, they aren't proactive, or they don't even schedule time to do it. What would you probably say from a novice entrepreneur, startup, a seasoned entrepreneur who's trying to grow their business? What are some things you did to start applying those things that your dad taught you as far as networking?
Yeah, I'd say one of the key things about networking is about using social capital. And the key thing about using social capital is if you don't use your social capital, you lose it. Okay. But then two, the important thing about networking is when you network, the best way you can enjoy your fruits of networking is don't network with looking for a return. Mm-hmm. Like network because you want to help people. You know, when you help people, when you want to help people, the return is going to come on its own and you don't have to think about it. You don't have to worry about it. You are networking. If you focus on networking because you want to help other people as opposed to what it's going to do for you, that's going to be the best type of networking.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And again, the connections and the, you sort of become sort of the human LinkedIn. Yeah. Automatically, right? You just do that automatically. You have interesting ideas to share with other people. And you know, one of the key reasons I network is for a very selfish reason, because I love listening to ideas from different people like Gary, when I talk to people because they have interesting ideas that you can't really learn from just watching movies or reading books or, anything else. Like you have to talk to people. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the biggest fruits I've gained from networking. So I think it's a key thing in networking is don't network because you're looking for that. You're looking for something tangible in return. Network because you want to help people.
So selfish networking really isn't networking, right? I mean, unselfish right. networking is the only, it's the only networking, because I agree with you. When I network with you and over this time and other great friends of mine, you can feel that they actually care about what you're doing and where you're going and how can they help, right? And if you're a compassionate person, you're like, man, I got to pay back more than they're paying me, right? I got to figure out how I can help them. And I think, that back and forth is just invaluable. And I can, there's so many things that I've done in my business. I've, bounced things off of you and said, hey, Biju, I got to meet with you, Biju. When can we meet up, right? We meet up, we talk about things and more ideas come from it. And then in my mind, I'm like, how can I help him more? Now he just gave me some nuggets that I can use. Now, Biju, how can I help you more, right? And I think if that's your mindset, you can't lose. Right?
Yeah, I think absolutely, and in that way of thought, basically in business, right? Being compassionate and being empathetic are super important in business because being compassionate, like, basically, hey, you're there to help people. And I think, the way I look at business in general, it's my philosophy about business in general, right? It's like business is a way to be compassionate to the world in some way. And you could do that through many different vehicles. You could work for a nonprofit. You could work for, you could work for the government. You could work for private enterprise. But it just turns out, because of the way, life has shaped me, my DNA, a company and a business is the best vehicle for me, just from my experience, mm-hmm. but it could be different for different people. But you have to, I think at the end of the day, the goal should still be the same. You should be compassionate to the world, and you want to help the world in some way. And you also, to really be most successful at business, you have to be empathetic. You have to have mm-hmm. empathy. Empathy helps in business.
If you don't, in my opinion, I think probably like yours, right? If you don't have that, in my opinion, people don't come to work passionate about working in your organization. They're not going to be as passionate about hitting the goals that you set out as a team to hit, right? And so I see that in businesses everywhere. The most empathetic, passionate leaders inspire other people to do more than they would do without them. And becomes a great organization instead of just a mediocre organization with a leader that, might not be inspiring as well as they could. So, awesome thoughts. I love that.
Absolutely. And that applies two ways. So it applies to your employees and it applies to your customers. Mm-hmm. So to employees, you can't motivate people just by paychecks and stock options, You can if you really want to motivate people, you have to motivate people by the mission and about how doing that mission is going to help them help the world. Okay, so it's not just about the paychecks they're going to get. Same thing for your customers. You know, if your only pitch to your customers is you have a product that's cheaper or faster or whatever, that's not enough to motivate customers either. Mm-hmm. So to customers too, you have to really, if you can make the pitch, and sometimes it's not easy to do that with every product in every instance, but, you know, overall, I think you can do that with a lot of different products. But if you can make the pitch about, hey, how this is with this product, like the way you deliver a certain product or service, you know, you can do something that's going to dramatically change the industry or change the world in something that's better, mm-hmm. is net positive.
Absolutely.
That motivates customers. I mean, that customer would be willing to pay more to use your product than a cheaper competitor because they feel like that's going to help the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Differentiation that creates value, right, in their eyes is key. And you know, they want to be able to tell their team why they're partnered with you and the value they get from that. And I, you know, I agree. I mean, our businesses are, if they're not built with great differentiation, then you know what? Go home. You're probably not going to be the company you want to be, your team members want to be, and your customers want to do business with. So I love it. What would you say are core values in personally right now, and core values that you bring to business every day? And what do you feel are the most valuable ones that you live by personally? You and your wife, your wife Lauren, and the kids, and then you're in business. Are there any similarities there in your eyes?
There are a lot of similarities. You know, I think at the end of the day, right? It boils back to this, that it comes back to the concept of like you being a business leader, okay? Being a better business leader, the same things that make you a better business leader are the things that make you a better human being. Okay, so that's critical. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of your personality carries over into your business. So I'll start with the business side, and I'll start with what we tell our entire team, our core values, and sort of what we live by on a day to day basis in the business. So core values in the business is not, like, our number one value is impact. You know. We have a financial product. We think our product is going to make it easier for people to invest and retire with more safety, invest and grow their money with more safety. And so, but we are driven really by the impact of that. We want to impact people around the world. We do a lot of business outside the United States and in the United States. And we have a product that we just don't think, this was a product that was traditionally sold to the very rich around the world, and we've sort of democratized this product and made it simple and easier, and we're getting along that process where we're making it for everybody. So number one goal is impact. Mm-hmm. And by impact, what we mean is how many different lives can we affect by this, with this product. So that's number one. Number two is... we want to basically create a product that our customers really love, okay? So this is beyond impact. This is also, hey, our customers really have to love. We want our customers to have a good experience with this product. And, you know, you're not going to be like, you want to have 100% of your customers always saying, hey, I love mm-hmm. your product. You're always going to have some people who really love your product, some people who, you know, want some things to be different and all of that. But net, we want to have a product that our customers really love. That's our value number two.
Raving fans, I call those.
Raving fans, big promoters, mm-hmm. you know, and different ways to measure that. But that's super important, that the fact that your customers really love their product.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is we want to create a culture that our employees really love. And that's really important for us, because if you don't have a great employee culture, you can't have a great... you can't really serve your customers well. You mm-hmm. can't then get your impact, right? So you have to have a culture your employees really love. And a culture your employees really love is, we've talked about this internally. We're like, it's not just about making our employees happy, right? Because there are sometimes, it's about making our employees feel like they've done something of significance. You know, it's significance that's more important than just happiness. Mm-hmm. So because there are a lot of things in life that, you know, don't just give you a positive emotion, but you feel very satisfied and significant after you've done it. So like running a marathon or climbing a mountain, you know, those are not like, you're not happy when you're running a marathon, you know, but you're satisfied. You're, you know, you feel like you've done something significant after you've run that marathon.
Speak for yourself.
Yeah.
I love marathons.
You love. Gary's
when
smiling.
When I do them someday. when I do them
someday in the future, right?
Yeah. Exactly. And then the key word is after. It's not during. Because during, you're like, what did I do? Why am I here? Absolutely.
So, but we want our employees to feel like they've traded their time to work with us, because they could have been anywhere else, right? They traded their time to work with us, and they've done something that's significant in their life. That sense of achievement is important for us, their employees feel. And number four, in terms of value, and this is like our least important value, it's still an important value, but it's our least important value, is basically make a profit, because we have to, you know, we have shareholders, we have stakeholders that we want to make a profit for.
Right. I'm looking for some big returns, brother.
Yeah, and in full disclosure, Gary is a shareholder in our company. So, but you know, I can say this. I can say this to you, Gary. You're a shareholder in our company, and I can say this to you because I feel like prioritizing the other three values before profits, right, mm-hmm. will actually help us deliver better profits, absolutely. And better values to you as a shareholder, mm-hmm. right? And that's key. That's really key, and it's so far it's worked out for us. You know, we're still in our process, we're still in our journey, but this is something I've learned through experience: is that hey, this is super important, like having your values mm-hmm. this way.
So how do you take your values home? You know, does Lauren want to really hear about them, or what? You know, mm-hmm. is she excited about the same values at home, or how do they vary?
I think at home the important thing is, you know, my wife and I have. You know, my wife and I have different interests, but we have very similar values. So, to Lauren and I think, you know, a lot of our key values go around. Hey, we have to raise our kids in the best way. We have to do fun things together. We have to, you know, we have our own different like, you know, travel to certain places, different things of greatness. You know, those are very significant. The things that at home too, what's important is the values for us at home are not just about, it's not for us about just buying a big house or a big car or a big boat or anything like that. If for us, the important things are the things that create memories for us. Mm-hmm. And memories are really travel, you know, other experiences we have in life, but also most importantly our kids, because at this point our kids are very young and life is a lot about our kids.
Yeah, so. It's gotta be. Awesome. Yeah, how about this new business that you've got going is an amazing organization that I think is going to just explode, and I think that again the impact you're going to bring to the world people that don't have $10 million to invest in a product, that they want to invest $1,000 or $10,000 or whatever, they're going to have access to this product through a lot of different vehicles. Tell me about that. How'd that come about, and you know, what started that idea, and then where did it go, and where is it at, and where is it going to go 5 years out, 10 years out?
Yeah. So, mm-hmm. so you know, I met my co-founder Jason. Thanks to you, Gary. So I met, you know, Gary had been telling me for a long time to meet Jason, and I finally met him, and basically, in 2 short months, we started talking about this idea, and. Our idea was basically that, you know, we saw this product called Structured Products. It was sold to the very rich in this country and around the world. And we found that this product actually had a lot of utility, had a lot of value. It helped these people protect. It basically gave them exposure to the market. It helped them make some money, but also gave them some protection when the market was swinging this way or the other. So we felt that, hey, this has a value to everybody. Why isn't everybody doing this? So, you know, we would meet basically every Sunday. We'd basically meet every Sunday for 4 hours, you know, whiteboarding this idea, you know, discussing. Because, you know, your idea is, whatever your first idea is always, not that it's wrong, but it always needs to be radically improved, right?
Well, let me interrupt for just a second. So, so Jason is a friend of mine that just like Bijou, when I met with Jason, anytime we'd have lunch, breakfast, we'd try to do it a few times a year at least. And every time I'd see these guys, I'd say, man, you got to meet my buddy Bijou. And Bijou, you got to meet my buddy Jason. And Jason's was a young guy with an amazing financial mind, making a great living, working for one of the biggest banks in the world. But you could tell, his father was an amazing entrepreneur. Eventually, we're going to get him on this podcast, Dennis. But amazing entrepreneur and an amazing person. And you can see that Jason had a little of that in him, right? He wants to someday loves what he's doing, and he's kicking butt, making a ton of money. But you know what? He's really an entrepreneur at heart. And so I kept on, every time I'd say, you got to meet my buddy Bijou. And eventually, sure enough, we had a fundraiser. I put them next to each other and they kind of pushed their wives to the side and said, you girls need to meet and talk, because these two, I want to spend some time together. But so it was just fun that, you guys got together and you came up with this idea. But it's so exciting going forward to see your friendships, how close you guys are today, how much you love each other and love working together. And two amazing, in my opinion, amazing minds are going to equate to some great things. So sorry to interrupt, but I had to say, Jason, just an amazing guy, amazing partner to have. In my opinion, I'm proud of you guys and what you're doing. But sorry.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And I think a lot of the success in our business is because, at least for me, I can speak personally, is that because they've got great partners, starting with Jason. Jason's a fantastic partner. I mean, he's amazingly passionate, passionate about the business, passionate about selling, and he really wants to change the world. He sincerely believes this.
Absolutely.
And I'm super fortunate to have him as a partner. So Jason, and then like some of the other, through Jason, I met some of our other board members, some of our other employees, and we've got a great partnership. And that's, it's one of the key things in starting a company for anybody. You're only as good as the people around you, starting with your co-founder, starting with your other partners, starting with your employees, starting with your board. Yep. Like all these elements are super critical to be successful. So that's sort of how it started, through Gary, through these connections.
But so where it's at today and where it's going tomorrow, I want to know where my money's going, dude. Am I going to make some money? Is something going to come about? Actually, I'm not even worried about that, but. In your opinion, where are you going, and where are you going to be 10 years from now with this business?
Yeah, so what's been great about the business is, in basically in a short 2.5 years, we've built a business that's become one of a leading platform for this product, which has made the product, easier, cheaper. It's still not everything we want it to be yet, but we've made dramatic improvements in the product. Where a lot of the leading banks, a lot of the leading brokerages around the world keep calling us. We speak to some of them, but they also call us saying, hey, they want to use this product. That's amazing validation.
Is there a generic name for the type of product?
It's called a structured product or a structured note.
Okay, there you go.
Most people haven't generally heard of it, but that's what we want to change, both in the United States and around the world. So we're actually doing business right now in the U.S., in Africa, and in Asia. So we've got customers in like three continents, North America, Africa, and Asia. And we will soon go to South America and then also to Europe. But we're finding banks and brokerage firms around the world basically really liking this product and validating this. And that's amazing, because in other businesses I've never gotten this sort of validation globally, right? And we want to take this where we really want to make this like a retail product. We want to make it so that a rice farmer in India can basically put some part of his savings that someday, it's not ready today, but at some point, basically use this product. So everybody in the world has access to this product, because that's where we think that investing will go. Because what happens right now, we feel on a very high level, is when people invest, they either go too safe, so they leave their money into cash and not earn a real return off of it, or they go too much risk in the stock market. So they don't really have a way to go somewhere in between, and this is what this product really lets them do. And we want to do that. We want to create the best experience for our customers and also make it really safe and easy for our customers.
And that product was available for very wealthy people prior with big banks. Is that correct? A similar product, I would say, right? And now it's going to be available to people that want to invest $10,000, $5,000, $2,000, whatever, right?
That's exactly right. So basically, this product was traditionally available only in very big sizes to the very rich. Mm-hmm. So at the big banks, so probably 95% of, but there's about $50, $60 billion of this product sold every year in the country. It's about $400 billion outstanding just in this country, but $3 trillion globally.
Wow.
But the $3 trillion globally is largely sold to the very rich. So even the U.S., 95% of that $50 to $60 billion or 95% of that $400 billion is available, is mostly sold to the super rich at the very big private banks, like at a Goldman Sachs or something like that. And we want to basically make it where somebody can go into their Schwab account or their Fidelity account and buy this in small sizes, but do it in the right way, you know, mm-hmm. with the right safeguards in place for that investor.
So 10 years down the road, where do you see Halo? I mean, what would you envision?
10 years down the road, I think that Halo will be in a lot of financial institutions around the world. We'll also have millions, maybe tens of millions, maybe hundreds of millions of retail customers around the world. So this is not, you know, we see the market as not just the United States, but global. And that's been the exciting part for us.
So when you think about valuation, you know, valuation today, valuation originally, the valuation today, and the valuation 10 years from now, what would you, if you said, hey, this is a, I'm going to throw a dart, but I think this is going to be pretty close, right, to the bullseye?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say valuations are things I don't like to talk on a podcast.
That's okay. But you're with your buddy. Right? Yeah, so nobody's going to hear this.
No one's going to hear this, right? Exactly. That's how podcasts work, right, Gary? But no, valuations are, I mean, we've been blessed. Like, our valuation's gone up a lot from our first round to where it is today. And we think it'll go up a lot, too. But that's, but I tell the team, too, all the time, right? That's not. When we look at that dashboard in our business, that's not the thing we want to focus on. We want to focus on impact. And impact for us is like, hey, are we looking at making this product simpler, cheaper, safer to get it to the maximum number of customers?
Could it be a $1 billion valuation in 10 years?
I think it'll be way sooner than that. All way
right.
sooner.
That's, there you go. We got something out of him anyway, right? All right. So my investment will be okay, I'm thinking. Good. So when you think about the, you know, whether it be your original businesses that, you know, you're a startup guy and in venture capital, you're investing in startups and now you have this business again. I think you still do some investing in some other stuff, but this is your main objective here to grow this. When you think about these, what are some lessons you learned where you really know you got beat down a little bit, you got knocked in the teeth and you had to get up, but it hurt. You know, what are some great lessons you learned through some pain, not just the normal, hey, we tried this, it didn't work, we're going to move on, right? But something that really kicked you in the teeth. What can you think back of something that you would say, man, that really hurt, but boy, I learned a lot.
Absolutely. So one, I'll say I love to learn. But the lesson I learned about learning is that the only way you can learn is to endure pain, right? Yeah. You're only going to learn through mistakes. You know, you're not going to learn as much through successes. You're going to learn a lot through failures. And I've had a lot of failures, but overall, net, things have worked out well for me. But one big lesson I learned is the importance of culture, is basically focusing a lot on culture. I think when I first started out, you know, I'm a sort of a technology guy. I focus a lot more on the technology and the product. And I think that, hey, if I learned how to code in a certain way, or if I learned to, build robotics in a certain way, and if I did that better than anybody else, I'd be successful. Sure. It's just about, and I didn't realize that I was really thinking just more about me. But what I've learned over the years is, you know, it's so important. Culture is way more important. Mm. Culture, you can have a bad product but good culture, and you can still win. But if you have good product but bad culture, you can lose.
Yes. Yep.
Right? And that's learned that through some painful lessons. But the why culture is so important is, if it's just you, right, you don't really need culture because you don't need to really talk to anybody,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, you're only talking to outside shareholders and people like that. But as soon as you go for more than just you to the second person in your team, to the third person, to the 10th person in your team, to the 100th person in your team, you have to, the 100th person in the team needs to know what you're thinking about or how you would have made a certain decision or how you both would have made a certain decision without talking to you about the decision, mm-hmm. right? And the only way they'll know that is to know what your values are, and the only way they'll you can communicate those values is through your culture.
Absolutely.
So culture is a way for you to communicate values to everybody in your team.
Great.
And that is super, super important. And that's the only way to win.
I agree, and I love it. I mean, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have thought about it either. I'm the same way, right? I just wanted to pave parking lots and driveways the best I could. Figured that, everybody just wants that. So you're going to get great culture because people are going to want to do the same thing that are working with you. And it's not quite the deal, right? I mean, you need people that really love doing what they do, and the cause has to be beyond building that great product even, right? So I agree 100%, and I know you do a great job with it. What do you believe, in your opinion, tell me how the free enterprise system has created these blessings in a way that maybe it wouldn't if you're in a socialist environment or just a non-free enterprise-driven environment, wherever that might be in the world. Tell me what you feel about those things.
Absolutely. And, I had the blessing of growing up in a country, so sometimes easy for, I think if I grew up in, if I only grew up in the United States, I could say I love free enterprise, but everything I know about socialism is something I read in books,
mm-hmm.
right? But I grew up in a country that was actually largely socialist.
Mm-hmm.
It was a democracy, but it was socialist.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see how long it took to get things done, how hard it was to get simple things done, like to get, if you wanted to get a phone line installed, it took months or years sometimes, mm-hmm. growing. And I grew up in India in my very early years, and it took a really long time to do very simple things. And it was intuitive even as a child to realize that, hey, this doesn't make sense. Like, there's no reason
mm-hmm.
something so simple should take so much time. So, I came to the United States at a very young age, and I was, I came here for school. I ended up, staying, and I've really lived here most of my life right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I can really see the difference. Now, the free enterprise system, like anything else, like capitalism, has its problems and has its disadvantages in different ways. But compared to every other system all around the world, and compared to how we implement it compared to other countries around the world, I still think it's the best. Okay, and I think, but also, if I think another critical thing is that if you really want to grow the free enterprise system globally, right? I think it's super important to build businesses, to promote that, but also look out for some of the people who fall through the cracks
mm-hmm.
in a system like this. Sure. I think it's possible to do both. I think sometimes the conversation in a country is too much around, hey, you either capitalists, or if you want to help someone who's not so lucky, you're not a capitalist, right?
Right. Yeah, right.
And I think that's the wrong conversation, right? I think it should be, I think you can actually, you can help the poor or people who need it better through capitalism than outside. And you see this around the world. Like a good example is China, okay? China has lifted more people out of poverty than any other country in the history of the world. And they lifted, although China is a communist socialist country,
mm-hmm.
they lifted people out of poverty through capitalism,
mm-hmm.
because they started, they had this guy ruling China named Deng Xiaoping. He was in this was in the late 1970s, early 1980s, and China was a socialist country. It had a very low GDP per capita, very poor, a lot of problems. But then, he just said, well, we could keep the the communist part around.
Don't want to lose that.
Well, we don't want to lose that, but we could actually help. You know, there are all these people who are really poor, and we could actually help. We could actually help these people. And so he created the first free enterprise zones in China, and that was, you know, Guangzhou, Shenzhen, and that's where the first few seeds of capitalism really came in China. And that's how the rest of China, that basically brought all this industry to China, and the rest of China completely prospered. You know, Deng Xiaoping was interesting because he basically said, you know, because people at that point were debating him or fighting him on the fact that he was bringing, you know, capitalist systems into China at that point. It was it's a very different China than it is today. And, you know, he famously said, he had this quote, he basically said, it doesn't matter if the cat is black or the cat is white, as long as it can catch mice. You know, so he basically said that. So he said it doesn't matter if it's communist or capitalist, if you can, you know, if you can solve these problems. But that's I think that's a critical thing, is like you have to at the end of the day, right, when we look at free enterprise, like, we can't say we like free enterprise just because it's called free enterprise. We like free enterprise because it is actually the best thing in the world, because by the results, mm-hmm. by the evidence, it's the best thing in the world.
So I think you know, some people like yourself have the amazing opportunity to have been from a country that isn't a free enterprise driven country. For me, I was my opportunity was when I started in paving and starting out of high school in business. I didn't get unemployment, so I had to work. I was looking for an unemployment check like my friends, and couldn't get one because I was self-employed. I worked in a factory for a friend of mine as on the line, right, in a plastics factory. And in that plastics factory, the greatest thing that happened was, you know, I'm working minimum wage. I think it was like $3.50 an hour or something like that. And I'm working next to all these immigrants. And the lessons I learned from these immigrants are amazing. All these people are working at minimum wage, maybe a tad more than minimum wage, and they had these aspirations, and they had these goals and these visions of success, because they knew they had opportunities in this free enterprise system. So I'd ask them, how come you're so excited about being here for the last year or 2 years and working in this factory? Tell me more, right? And it was awesome to listen to, you know, a friend I gained from Russia, a couple of friends from China, Mexico, and all over the world in this factory. So again, I was blessed to have the lessons from these people that had been there for a short period of time. Here I was a 19, 20-year-old guy, confident in my way, but didn't understand the opportunity I had ahead of me until I really got to know these people. So I was like, gosh, I speak the language. I've grown up here. I've got such great opportunity. And so I think that was something that happened to me, that if it didn't happen, I'd be a different person today. I have friends like you that have come from these other countries as young adults or kids and adults that are here with the same mentality, and I watch them and how they tackle this free enterprise system in a way differently than many of us that have been born here. So I appreciate that your opinions on it, because I love listening to people like you that understand both sides, right? And actually the opportunities or the potential benefits to a different socialist system, communist system, and how they might think differently and have some success as well. Right.
Absolutely, and the cool thing is, when you look at countries like even the country I grew up in, India, it's way more free enterprise now than it was before, because they're also practical. At a certain point, they're like, okay, we need to make these changes if we have to get anywhere. The cool thing is, this is how the rest of the world is. It's just becoming more free enterprise. Mm-hmm. But truly, if the free enterprise system is not a static system. It's an evolving system.
Absolutely.
And we have to keep making changes to it. And I think in some ways, like, some of our biggest struggles with that come from within this country itself. Like, we have to, you know, like, there are a lot of people like us who are blessed in different ways through a system like this. But then there are a lot of other people who don't, you know, who can't get ahead. And we need to solve for both. And I think it's doable. It's not a contradictory statement to say, well, you can have great businesses, but you can also, help the poor. I think we can do both. And I think it's also a moral thing to do. Mm-hmm. I think morally, it's the right thing to do. And if you do that thing, it's actually better is a free enterprise system.
The balance is key, right? Where is the balance? And everybody has different opinions on what that balance looks like. You know, in my opinion, you know, in the free enterprise system, businesses that are successful usually are giving back a ton, usually invest in great causes. And that seems like the most efficient giving that I've ever seen compared to tax higher, tax more, right. tax higher, right. right? Compared to that, where it's right. almost feels like theft, in my opinion, right? Where you're taxed at a crazy rate because you've been successful. Well, if I can do more with that money in a free enterprise system and in a foundation and giving that we do, then gosh, you know what? Hey, slow up on the taxes. We can invest that money better. 100% goes to the cause instead of 10% that might go to the cause in the tax system.
Right.
So again, we're back. You're always back and forth on this. Where's the happy medium? Because you definitely need to be a community that supports those that can't support themselves in any way at all, right?
Yep.
Well, I got a question for you. Not to kind of just shift gears a little bit. What will probably be some of the, you know, you have a lot of wisdom, you know, to be honest with you. I'm over here. My mind is just like, you know, what would be probably one of the, some of the most inspiring things that, or advice that you can give for aspiring people who want to be, you know, have wisdom like yourself, or honestly just as successful as you are, would probably be some advice to kind of get to the ground floor and kind of get the ball rolling on some things.
So I would say, I don't know about the wisdom part, but I would say just from whatever, you know, my own sort of what I think about is like, I think, so I'd say if, you know, what I tell the younger version of myself, yeah. at least, let me put it that way. If I were talking to the younger version of myself from 20 years ago, I would say, don't focus as much on the money or the product, focus on the change. Like, you just really focus on the change and solve a lot of little problems. You know, because people, one thing I've noticed with people, even I was sort of like this, is that, you know, when I was young, I would think about a little bit about what is this big problem that I need to solve. I was always looking for this big problem. And realizing that, you know, the way you solve big problems is really solving a lot of small problems. And if you, the most important thing is focus on change, not on money. Focus on change and just focus on solving problems in the world. And because you're solving problems in the world, focus on being useful to the world. Just be useful to the world. And then that's really the best way to learn things, to do well, to be successful. That's really the simplest way to do it.
And if you remember, we had a gentleman, Ori Levine, who's the founder of Waze, that was with us for a few days. Looking at things, you know, I had him out looking at things we're doing and how we can be better with technology. You met him, didn't you? And he showed up and he always had a different T-shirt on, but the T-shirt that got me was it was just a T-shirt that said, you know, show me your problem, right? Show me your problem. And you know, he sincerely believes, just like you just said, right? I just want to know the problem. Tell me the problem. I want to fix the problem. If I can fix the problem for more people than anybody else in the world, we're gonna do some good things, right? So no, it's funny you say that, because I was trying to get you to meet him as well when he was here, because I think, you know, your minds would really feed off each other. But I think it was just funny. You had this big T-shirt on it.
Yeah, let's just get you to a fundraiser with him and then make sure their wives are separate and then go ahead and have you all talk.
Gary's got the formula right. So.
Exactly.
You know, another question from a perspective of, why do you think businesses fail currently, specifically right now in this day and age?
I think very simply, like, a lot of businesses fail because they don't really, you know, they just have to persevere. It's because of a lack of grit. Mm. You know, I just say grit, because even if your idea is the worst idea in the world, there's something you can change it to. I think the key thing is, you know, to be good at business, you have to, especially when you are when you're doing something that's disruptive, you have to be firm in certain ways, but be flexible in other ways. You have to be this contradiction of being firm and flexible.
Yeah.
And it's a contradiction because in certain things you're going to be very firm, but certain things you'll be very flexible. And you should know, like, you should just be honest, and that's a key thing. You can sell whatever you want to the rest of the world, but at the end of the day, internally you have to be honest, because when you look at, hey, if you know, a lot of people think a time to fix a business is when, you know, it completely goes underwater, but then it's usually too late, yeah. right? You have to, the real way to fix businesses is you have to sort of, the best time to fix it is you'll start seeing a lot of telltale signs much earlier, and that tells you, hey, you know what? This is not the right thing, but somebody else has this problem and this problem and this problem that they need to be solved, that they need to solve, and you just have to solve those problems.
So to be receptive, flexible, but decisive, right? I mean, as a leader,
you have to be decisive. You have to be decisive, but you also, it really is that contradiction. Mm. You have to be decisive and firm in certain ways, but you also have to be totally flexible and willing to have an open mind, and you have to keep both. Mm. And that sounds like a strange mixture to a lot of people, but it's true though. It's the only way. You have to be decisive on certain things. You can't be flexible in everything.
So one more thing I'd like to ask is this, you know, in your life at this point, in your business life, I guess business life mostly, education-wise, your formal education, I know a little bit about it, but you know, tell us about that, and then your informal education of mentorship and networking and all that. Where do you feel the biggest values come from in your life and the success you've had today?
My formal education, I have a degree in aerospace engineering, and you know, that was great, but like that was just a nice time spending, like, you know, 3 years. I finished my degree in 3 years of. 3 years with some smart people and talking to smart people, but you know, the degree itself didn't really mean much to me. You know, it was just a fun time going to some parties. You know, that was probably what, you know, all the tuition paid for. I think that's not where you really learn. I think you really learn from talking to people, reading books, and you know, just getting ideas really from people. Because what you see is, you know, there are problems you think need to be solved, but then when you actually go to the market, when you go to the world, and what actually hits you, the opportunities are different than the problems. Sure. Right? It's one thing to solve a problem, but the other is to basically get on top of an opportunity. And an opportunity is like, it's like a wave. And so you see the wave, you just jump on the wave. And regardless of, you know, how smart you think you are, the market's telling you, or the world is telling mm-hmm. you, hey, you know what, this is where the wave's going to flow, and you jump on top of that wave.
Awesome.
Awesome, man. Awesome.
I love it.
Yeah, this has been amazing. This has been really
I told
really
you it was going to be amazing. Yeah. Did I tell you or did I tell you? Definitely did. You know, in the most important books you've read, and you read a lot, just like I think, you know, many of us do. You know, what's a book or two that you'd say, man, if you want to be an entrepreneur, you want to build something in your own, you want to be successful in business, what's something you've read that you say, man, this is a great book that if I could only read one or two books, these are a couple books that I really believe in.
You know, it's interesting. I've had very little like formal entrepreneurship books that I've really read. I've really listened to a lot of talks. And so in these podcasts are a blessing, you know, YouTube is a blessing, you know, a lot of people giving TED Talks are a blessing. Like, those are talks I've really learned a lot from than even books per se today. I'd read a lot more before the invention of the iPhone, but nowadays I still read a lot, and I read really interesting books, but I don't really read that much necessarily about entrepreneurship. I read about just other different intellectually curious things for me, but yeah, not 100% of entrepreneurship, but I love TED Talks. Like, TED Talks are great.
Sure.
You know, then there is listening to a podcast called Masters of Scale by Reid Hoffman. That's something I really love. Then there's another podcast as a startup or an entrepreneur. Listening to a podcast, there's one that Y Combinator, Sam Altman from Y Combinator puts out, and that's also really good. Those are all great
podcasts. So those will all be like just, you know, second, third, fourth behind Ditch Digger CEO.
That's
eventually.
What I was going to say. Absolutely. Same thing.
Yeah. You know why? You know why? Because Ditch Digger CEO is still not released on the iTunes Store.
That's right.
As soon as it's released.
Watch out.
Watch out, Reid Hoffman.
That's right. Okay, so hey.
Gary Rabine's coming for you.
Exactly. Is that who I'm coming after?
Reid?
Reid, look out. Rogan, whoever you are out there, look out. Okay, so when you think about, you know, let's put yourself now out there, 65, 75 years old, right? You're looking back, you got a couple grandkids running around, and And you know, what do you want to be? What do you want to be looked upon as delivering to the, to this world? And if your kids are thinking about you, you know, you're maybe, you know, thinking about, hey, what did I do different, or what did I bring to this world positively? What do you want to be looked upon as at that point?
You know, even at 65, I hope to be actively working and doing something.
I'm not saying you're dead yet.
I'm not retiring. Or
it's only 10 years away from me, so it's a lot longer for you.
No, I'll still be at another startup, but I want to. And if I look back in the rearview mirror at that point, right? Hopefully, there's some. You know, I'm sure I'll have a bunch of failed startups, some burning cars, but I also have some great cars in the rearview mirror. And I want to sort of like look at the great cars that are positive impact, that have turned out to be positive impact. And I just feel overall like, you know, if I can contribute like some net positive impact to the world, mm-hmm. which is for me so far the vehicle to do that has been these startups. If I can do it through these startups, I'd be super thrilled.
Well, most people would look back at your short business career and say, you've already done more than most people are ever going to do in their lives. I can't wait to see what it's going to look like in 20 years for my buddy. That's for sure, because it's going to be amazing.
Yeah, so, man.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, here's just some of the Quentin True takeaways that we got from Ditch Digger CEO with Biju. One, first, don't just survive, but improve on your mistakes. That was actually really good. Don't network looking for a return, which I think a lot of people actually do all the time. Things that make you a good business leader will make you a better human being. That was awesome.
Things that make you a better human being make you a better business leader.
That is true. Don't focus on money or product. Focus on change. But leaders are readers. But I think the biggest one that you said that I'm going to take away is the biggest reward is impact. And Biju, that's mm-hmm. what you do every single day, man. That's awesome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, buddy, thanks for being here. Really appreciate it. I tell you what, you know, I told Quentin this is going to be like the best, and he was getting. I know he's good, but
you
man, the best.
You didn't steer me wrong.
Biju's going to be the best, and so we appreciate you being here, buddy. You did it. You know, you're awesome, and I really cherish your friendship. So thanks.
Thank you. Me too.
We'll see you all next time, Ditch Digger CEO.
See ya. If you enjoy this show, please share with anyone else you think will find value here. And please go to our website, ditchdiggerceo.com, for show notes, links, video clips, and more nuggets of entrepreneurial wisdom. Don't forget to follow me on social media at ditchdiggerceo and at Gary Rabine. If you listen to our show and want to become more successful, you will become more successful. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Lord, I was called Ditch Digger. Discovered entrepreneurship, scaling business plans. Then I became the CEO man. We're blessed to build a business in America, where soldiers fight for our freedom every day. Dad's work ethic was taught from the seat of a gravel truck, rolling down Highway 31. Lord, I was called Ditch Digger Man, paving for a living and doing the best I can. Discovered entrepreneurship, scaling business plans. Then I became the CEO.